The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 10 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973 for all of your insurance needs. And now it's time to return one last time to Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina, for the last time in March 2021, before we over the cover of the April issue. And this being the last reading of the month, we're going to hit the decades article first. We've done the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, and we are now up to the 90s. 1970s, the decade of disruption. And the title of this month's article is The Wilmington 10, and they are pictured here in the double spread. Following an incident at a local high school, long simmering racial tensions boil over in Wilmington, culminating in the wrongful conviction of 10 activists. Written, as always, by Philip Gerard. Here's the photo of these folks. It says, members of the Wilmington 10 in 1976. If you think you might know some of the names, here they are. Ben Chavis, Joe Wright, Connie Tindall, Jerry Jacobs, Wayne Moore, Ann Shepard, James McCoy, Willie Vereen, Marvin Patrick, and Reginald Epps. On Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, January 15, 1971, a delegation of black students at John T. Hoggard High School presents a simple request to their principal, C.D. Gurgenis. Allow us to honor him, writes Wayne Moore, then an 11th grader. We just wanted a pause, some kind of memorial held in the school's auditorium in the name of Dr. King and all that he had accomplished. Wilmington is laboring through a third year of court-ordered desegregation of its three public high schools. This is a moment that could diffuse the smoldering tension among black students who feel like beleaguered refugees at their new school. The administration dismisses their request. During lunch that day, two dozen black students gather around tables in the cafeteria, angry at being turned down. One of them, William Joe Wright Jr., grabs the microphone in the campus radio booth and tells the whole school that they are staging a sit-in to honor Dr. King. 15 students, including Moore, are expelled. Williston. On June 26, 1968, against the objections of the black community, the new Hanover County Board of Education voted to close Williston Senior High School and redistribute its 1,100 black students among the two white high schools, New Hanover and Hoggard. Chairman Emsley Laney explained, "We felt it would be very difficult to integrate Williston High School and send white students there. It was a black neighborhood." For generations, Williston was an engine of upward mobility in the black community. It traced its origins to 1865, when the American Missionary Association arrived in Wilmington to set up classes in local churches for recently liberated black people. Williston teachers were revered in their community. In his memoir, Moore writes, "If this book had a million pages, it still wouldn't be enough to completely convey the bone-deep, heart-deep, pride-deep, love-deep place Williston Senior High School occupied for generations." Hoggard opened in 1967 as a modern facility on a 67-acre suburban campus about 5 miles southeast of Williston. a 40-minute bus ride for some black students. Instead of being able to walk home from after-school activities, many black students find themselves stranded far from their neighborhoods or else unable to participate. And while racial confrontations happen at both high schools, Hoggard becomes the flashpoint. Black students endure name-calling and physical abuse from white students, and they must also fend off belligerent white non-students who infiltrate campus. The MLK birthday sit-in and expulsions mark a turning point. Students meet with the superintendent, Dr. Hayward C. Bellamy, on January 26 and urge him to investigate. When it appears that he will do nothing, they decide to boycott classes. Their numbers quickly swell to the hundreds. On January 27, two representations of the boycotting students ask the Reverend Eugene Templeton, the white pastor of a black congregation, for permission to use the Gregory Congregational Church as a meeting place. Besides the MLK expulsions, Templeton learns that a black student was struck with a bottle in a melee near New Hanover High. When the matter was brought to the attention of the principal by the black girl, he suspended her for missing class, Templeton later writes. No further action was taken by the school authorities to find out who the white boy was. And there is more. A coach has beaten a black student over the head. Faculty and police have harassed black students. The students barricade themselves inside the brick church, which seemed like something out of a fairy tale, like a castle, some place strong and safe, Moore later writes, and Templeton sends for help. Who answers his call? A passionate young activist named Benjamin Franklin Chavis, Jr. The Peacemaker. During her 14 years at Williston, librarian Bertha Boykin Todd became a mentor and confidant to students, and now she assumes the role at Hoggard, where she is transferred along with about half of the Williston faculty to a chilly reception. She writes, "If this is the welcome that the Williston faculty members get, just how will the black students be treated?" She declares that she belongs to all students, no matter how what their race or their politics. At one point, she heads off an unruly crowd of students marching down a hallway toward an apparent confrontation and shepherds more than 300 of them into the gym for an impromptu assembly, a peacemaking session that lasts 4 hours. Mrs. Todd was sort of like a legend for a lot of us black students at Hoggard, Moore writes. She wasn't just charming, she had ideas. She stocks the library with books by and about African Americans. She creates the Viking 16, named for the students' mascot. 8 black and 8 white students who pledge to work together to de-escalate tensions. She buys a used car and gives it to a football player so that he and his fellow black players have a ride home after practice. Most significantly, she organizes a series of lunch period speakouts, allowing white and black students to air their thoughts freely. The activist, Benjamin Franklin Chavis, Jr., makes an indelible first impression. Charlie Jones, one of the leaders of the boycott, watches the 23-year-old activist arrive in a 1970 royal blue with a half-white vinyl top Eldorado. He was wearing a brown fur coat and a big afro. He looked more like a pimp than a revolutionary. Todd fears that he's too young to provide the students with steady leadership. Chavis begins his first press conference on February 2nd with a chant, "Black power, power to the people." Then he reiterates the students' demands, including reinstatement of the students expelled on MLK's birthday and a deadline for a response, noon the following day. Ben Chavis had snatched my breath, Moore writes. His charisma was that powerful, like a wind blowing us away. The next night, armed white people fire on Gregory Church, some likely from a group calling themselves the Rights of White People. 3 businesses are torched. Fearing more violence, Templeton pleads with the mayor and the police chief for a curfew. He is refused. The next day, hundreds of black citizens march peacefully to City Hall to demand protection, but are also refused. Some of the students now carry weapons for self-defense. That evening, the Reverend David Vaughn stands outside the church, urging students to disarm themselves. Suddenly, a motorcade of white vigilantes opens fire, and Vaughn falls, peppered with buckshot. As the white vigilantes step up their attacks, an armed cadre joins the students, some soldiers and ex-soldiers, and they may or may not be responsible for the firebombings that ensue. Between February 5th and the end of the month, 20 more buildings go up in flames. One is Mike's Grocery across the street from Gregory Church, seen as a staging area for the vigilantes. At around 10 p.m. on February 6th, as it burns out of control, a policeman shotguns to death a young black man named Steve Mitchell, who is standing nearby. Police claim Mitchell had his own shotgun, but his friends say he was unarmed. Moore reports that at the time of Mike's Grocery fire, he was babysitting his sister's kids about a mile away. Templeton and his wife tell police that 50 bullet holes were fired into their parsonage, but they get no help. Police erect barricades around the church, but somehow white vigilantes drive through. The next morning, a white supremacist named Harvey Cumber drives through police lines in his pickup and draws a gun, advancing on the church. He's shot and killed. Now, Mayor Luther Cromartie imposes a 7:30 p.m. curfew, and the governor orders in the State Highway Patrol and the National Guard, who storm the now vacated church. A hue and cry erupts from the white citizens to hold someone accountable for the mayhem, but it's hard to know exactly who did what. Police and the FBI target Chavis. Over 3 months, they arrest 10 individuals who are eventually charged with arson and conspiracy to commit arson and conspiracy to fire on police and firefighters. Reginald Epps, Jerry Jacobs, James McCoy, Wayne Moore, Marvin Patrick, Connie Tyndall, Willie Earl Vereen, Joe Wright, and a white social worker named Ann Shepherd and Chavis. Justice. The first jury selected consists of 9 black and 3 white jurors, and the prosecutor, Jay Stroud, engineers a mistrial by feigning illness. Selecting a new jury, he uses 41 of 42 peremptory challenges to exclude black jurors. A key witness for the prosecution is Alan Big Al Hall, a large, violent man with a history of mental instability, who, during the pretrial hearings, leaps from the stand to attack Chavis and his attorney. A second is Jerome Mitchell, himself indicted for robbery and murder, dealing for leniency. A weeks-long trial ends on October 17, 1972, after 3 hours of deliberation. Guilty. The defendant's combined sentences, 282 years. Several years later, all three prosecution witnesses recant their testimony. In 1978, Governor Jim Hunt commutes the Wilmington 10 sentences, but declines to grant a pardon. Chavis, the last to be paroled, leaves prison just before Christmas 1979. Finally, in December 1980, the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals overturns all 10 convictions, finding that the guilty verdicts were based partly on perjury and prosecutorial misconduct. In 2012, 40 years after their original conviction, Governor Beverly Perdue signs a pardon of innocence for the 10 justice of a kind has been for the 10 of them. Justice of a kind has been served, but far too late. If only Principal Gerganus had allowed a memorial. If only the school board hadn't shuttered Williamston. If only the school had been more welcoming to black students. If only the police had protected the students against white vigilantes. If only. The students' adult leaders failed them, closed their beloved school, left them unprotected from racist bullies, deprived them of a fair chance to learn and participate. So one day, a handful of them stood up in a high school cafeteria and declared their principles, and they would not sit back down. Coming next month, in Asheboro, North Carolina, reinvents the American Zoo. You are listening to Our State Magazine on the North Carolina Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-781-1973. Ramblin' Man. Each month, T. Edward Nickens roams and writes on our Carolina countryside. This month, Pigeons Passing By. Centuries ago, migrating passenger pigeons flew south by the millions, great rivers of feathers streaming through the sky. Those birds are gone now, but their memory is a reminder to look up. Spring still brings a flood of winged wonder. Written by T. Edward Nickens. I'm not sure why this time of year makes me think of passenger pigeons. Perhaps it's the solitary wandering through winter woods that seem nearly devoid of birds, save for a few nuthatches and hardy titmice. Of course, along creek bottoms in Umstead State Park and on an hour-long hike, I can count the number of birds in one hand, or maybe it's the contrast between those meager sightings and what I know will be a trickle and then a flood of migrating birds just a month or two away. But for now, it's all just bare winter branches, which brings to mind a time when even the winter woods thronged with birds, so many that they brought branches to the ground, so many that they nearly drove local residents mad, so many that it's hard to imagine that not a single one is left. Legend and lore abound around the wandering billions of Ectopistes migratorius, tales of plenty and plunder that fill the 3.5 centuries from the first European mention of the bird by Cartier in 1534 to the final breath drawn by the last of the species, the famous Martha of the Cincinnati Zoo on September 1, 1914. Most observers of these flocks were so struck with wonder that they could hardly attempt to number the birds. The ornithologist Alexander Wilson was among the first to shake loose from dumbfounded awe and start counting. In the early 1800s, he was ranging through the woods near Frankfort, Kentucky, when a flock of pigeons appeared overhead. The flock continued unabated for 4 full hours, a continuous stream of birds followed by detached regiments bringing up the rear for another hour longer. Wilson began to calculate. If the flock was 1 mile wide, and he believed it was wider, and moved at 60 miles an hour, probably a bit too fast, then the 4-hour flight would have made the flock 240 miles long. Multiplying how many birds he figured occupied a square yard in the flock, Wilson arrived at an estimate of more than 2 billion birds, an almost inconceivable multitude, he admitted, and yet probably far below the actual amount. Such large flocks occasionally filtered east of the Appalachians and on into the oak woods of the North Carolina Piedmont, and when they arrived, they did so all in their feathered glory. One winter roosting left such an impression on the Moravians that a retrospective of the community's early history recounted the event, though it had happened nearly 35 years earlier. In 1760, an extraordinary occurrence happened about the center of the Wachovia Tract, on a creek to this day called the Pigeon Branch, which has the appearance of an improbability, yet actually happened to the great amazement of the beholders, viz., an incredible number of wild pigeons assembled there every night for a month together in a small district, perching manyfold upon one another, so as by their weight to break down the largest limbs of oaks, bending the tops of others to the ground. The noise was so terrible that a man speaking to his next neighbor could not be heard without bawling loud, and wagon loads of pigeons killed with sticks were carried off. The next year, the pigeons were so numerous and resided for so long that the locals seemed relieved when they finally 2 feet of snow at last drove the pigeons away after 2 months. Other notable roostings occurred in the winters of 1799. In 1806, when near Salem alone, many thousands were killed with sticks at night. And in 1814, when the birds were first referred to in the Moravian records as passenger pigeons. Not long after the great pigeon roosts vanished from North Carolina, there is a report of a roosting 4 miles square in Surrey County in the winter of 1842. The birds stayed 17 nights, wrote William Holland to his son Francis, then a Moravian missionary to Jamaica in Jamaica. Then the pigeons left and flew over the mountains. In the landmark Birds of North Carolina, published in 1942, the authors recorded the final sightings of a passenger pigeon flock in North Carolina. They were told of a flock about 1 mile wide thronging across Alamance County in 1871 or 1872. There are 3 records of pigeons in the state in 1880, on April 18th, 1891, H.H. Brimley, the first curator and later director of what is now the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, followed a single bird for hours through pinewoods near Raleigh. 3 years later, a female was collected up in the mountains near Weaverville. That was it. No more, at least not in North Carolina. If you wish, you can see the very last of the passenger pigeons, the famous Martha of the Cincinnati Zoo. It's unclear when and where she was born, in 1885 at the zoo perhaps, but on September 1st, 1914, she perished and toppled off her perch. Her body was encased in 300 pounds of ice and shipped to the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., where she remains mounted and on exhibit at the National Museum of Natural History. In the beech groves of Umstead, the winter woods seem to be waiting. Soon enough, these trees will nearly quiver with tanagers and warblers and sparrows and thrushes, but the pigeons will never return. Within the lifetime of a single human, the passenger pigeon vanished. Gone are the feathered rivers and the sky, the thunderous roosts with their crackling timber. In their place is a deep felt void and a sadness that stalks me on these late winter hikes. I'll never see a passenger pigeon, and I hope to never know that day when the world must bid another bird adieu. The ornithology collection at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences, started by longtime museum director H.H. Brimley and his brother C.S. Brimley, is now one of the largest of its kind in the Southeast. Among its 20,000 avian specimens, two rare birds, a passenger pigeon, and a Carolina parakeet find life after extinction. The North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences is located at 11 West Jones Street in Raleigh. Their website is naturalsciences.org. Well, let's see. We have a few more minutes left. Let's try an article on Passport to Panama, Wilmington. A vibrant seafood restaurant transports diners from one treasured coast to another, serving Central American dishes made with North Carolina ingredients. Written by Diana Oates. At Ceviche's in Wilmington, fresh seafood is the canvas on which ingredients of all colors collide. Jerk shrimp skewers served with coconut curry sauce, crunchy cashews, and pickled cabbage. Mahi-mahi ceviche topped with jalapeno, red onion, red pepper, cilantro, and house-made hot sauce. From selling fresh fish on disposable plates at its grand opening 7 years ago to become one of the area's in-the-know spots, Ceviche's has been well-received. Despite the fact that owners Hunter and Laura Tiblier started out with no real restaurant experience. Although I didn't know much about the restaurant industry, I knew that people love my ceviche, Hunter says. Whether I was at a party or traveling the world, I would make ceviche and people would tell me that I had to sell it one day. Hunter learned the art of making his restaurant's namesake seafood dish in Panama, where he spent much of his childhood fishing in both the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Although Hunter is originally from Mississippi, his father took a job as a captain steering ships through the Panama Canal when Hunter was very young. The concept for the restaurant came about during a trip to Panama when Hunter took his wife Laura to meet his parents. Hunter had just retired from a 26-year military career and wanted to try something new. I was taking Laura around the stalls of the Central Fish Market, and we were eating ceviche of all kinds, he says. And it was there that the light bulb moment came to Laura that we should actually sell my ceviche. The couple returned to Wilmington and, with a leap of faith, opened Ceviche's in 2014. The exterior boasts vibrant shades of yellow, blue, and green that hint at the colorful food inside. A magnificent mural on the side of the building features a lush landscape showcasing the flora and fauna of Central America, painted by a former member of the kitchen staff. But inside, a simple, authentic setup of rattan, wood, and abstract tile allows the food to do the talking. The Tibliers have opened up a window to an entire culture by delivering dishes that you dive into if you were sitting oceanside in Panama. The shining star is the corvina, a type of fish that can be found on every menu in Panama. It's flown to Wilmington from the Pacific Ocean and delivered to the restaurant daily. There it goes hand in hand with the Sea Love Margarita as the most ordered menu items. The Tibbliers believe in building everything, including drinks, on real flavors and ingredients. No fillers necessary. Terra Vita Farm, Sea Love Sea Salt Company, and area Latino markets help source seasonings, microgreens, avocados, and plantains to ensure the dishes are authentic but with a local assist. We took the time to teach our kitchen staff the secrets to getting the food to taste just as it would at home, Hunter says. We've got empanadas, ropa vieja, sancocho, and arroyo con pollo. But I think the locals would tell you to order the fish special of the night. While Hunter's love of Panamanian culture made him the person he is today, he also has the utmost respect for his new community in Wilmington, which, along the way, started to feel like home. I've gotten so many decorations in the military, he says, but truthfully, just the feeling that the overwhelming support I get from the community makes me feel more awarded and honored than any of these recognitions. Savisha's is at 7210 Wrightsville Avenue in Wilmington. They are at wbsavish.com. And there's a short article here entitled To-Do List, Cook, Read, Learn, and Celebrate What North Carolina Has to Offer This Month. Walk Through History. In honor of Women's History Month, take a self-guided walking tour that follows the footsteps of one of North Carolina's African-American icons, Harriet Jacobs. While enslaved in 19th century Edenton, Jacobs faced severe abuse and mistreatment, which led her to hide in her paternal grandmother's attic for nearly 7 years. Despite numerous hardships, Jacobs became a notable abolitionist and a prolific writer. Her memoir, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, is one of the only published narratives by a former enslaved woman. On the 13-stop tour, learn about Jacobs' early life, her escape to the North, and Edenton's role in the Underground Railroad. A couple of advertisements here, one for Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. We make great neighbors, North Carolina's residential real estate leader, bhhscarolinas.com. And the Biltmore suggests that you experience Biltmore like a guest of the Vanderbilts. That sounds like a good idea. George and Edith Vanderbilt built their southern gateway so that friends and family could renew their spirits in fresh mountain air and unmatched hospitality. Today, staying overnight on the estate affords you the same luxuries, so come, relax, and enjoy Biltmore as it was intended. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll join us next month for the April issue. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org, and it's also available on iTunes. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.